From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Nice to have you with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll open our week in review with the voice of an old friend. NPR listeners knew the voice of Robert Siegel for many years, often as the host of All Things Considered. Siegel retired last year.
He came to Rochester to visit with the WXXI community, and we had the chance to sit down with him on Connections. Here's part of that conversation with Robert Siegel. I'm wondering if you were running the news department today, how you would feel about the increased call from some in the public for NPR or the New York Times or any outlet to be more direct and overt with these terms. Lie, racist. You know, the idea is you have to say that that's racist. You have to say that this is a lie. And I know you heard that at times when you were there before your career finished up there at NPR. But how do you feel about that, Robert?
Well, I mean, my last season there, which was 2017, I remember the first time that I used the word lie in a lead or just saying this is not true or this is, you know, and it didn't come easily. It didn't come easily. I was kind of raised on the journalism that someone would make an assertion and then you would say something like, that was contradicted by the fact that blah, 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 you'd say that, and you would leave as the syllogism, the uncompleted syllogism, this was a lie, this was not truth. I found it difficult to use lie at first. I got more comfortable with it as 2017 went on. Racist is a little bit harder because it is less of a yes or no question. Is something racist? Well, many things may be racist in the perception of some people and not racist in the perception of others. I do believe that the birtherism campaign, I believe, was at its core racist in some way, although one could make an argument for it that it was, I suppose it wasn't. I like to think of the post-Trump era of American media. I've asked some colleagues and other media about that, that this peculiarly hostile relationship between a president and the press, perhaps not as actually damaging in some respects as the Nixon relationship was with the media, but full of verbal abuse and insult and dismissing the media as enemies of the people and all this. I don't think this is the new normal of American life. I'd like to think that something at some point will subside to a more normal hostility between the press and people in office. And I would hate to see news organizations like NPR and the New York Times become so wrapped up in their criticism of public officials that the vocabulary of public discourse becomes toxic forever in this country, that everybody is either a cheat, a liar, a fake, is corrupt. And so to my mind, those words are powerful, and when they're necessary, we've learned to use them without flinching, I think. Liar more easily than racist, I'll admit. But something in me is a little traditional about it, and would rather see us demonstrate the case for those words in a couple of sentences than use the words are less important to me than the demonstration in script that a statement is untrue, and it's the person saying it knows it's untrue or should know it's untrue.
Sure, and inevitably,
it's not a very satisfying answer, I know.
No, but
I'm a bit confused about it.
I think the ongoing conversation within journalism is valuable here.
Yeah.
And I understand why some in the public are impatient with answers like that, but I think it's important.
I should say, I took part in the coverage of the Clinton impeachment, and ostensibly the question of that was, is Clinton a liar? You know, is he a perjurer? And I think in the end the answer was, most people in the country probably said, yeah, I know. I assume he lied about that, but I'm not going to. I don't think he should be removed from office.
But what I take issue with in the term liar,
yeah,
is that there's plenty of psychological study that indicates every human being in this country lies multiple times in a day.
That's right. You're right.
And every president lies, every political leader lies. So what you're actually hearing from the public is we want you to define that this is a new level and has crossed the threshold of acceptability.
Yeah.
But I think it's better to isolate case by case instead of, you know, putting an overarching label. Just like this president has done things that, to me, are very clearly racist. Yeah. I don't have a problem with saying it, but I understand why you're saying the hope is that this is not forever here.
And there is a distinction, as you say, between an action or a statement being either a lie or a racist and the person saying it being designated the liar or the racist. I've never seen it at the source, but I once heard someone attribute a quotation to Samuel Johnson that from mere inferiority, nothing may be inferred. And meaning that when things are really low and bad, you can't really derive rules from these experiences. I think that was the meaning of it. And in a way, I think that the biggest national news media have behaved rather well during these years of being blasted for distributing fake news and lying. And I think that the Times and the Post, above all, some of the commercial networks, and sometimes NPR, a little bit less so perhaps, have been robust in their journalism and challenging statements of politicians and putting them to the test of truth. So I don't get the feeling that our problem right now is a deferential press.
In our next clip, we have the honor of sitting down with Sadai Kasayoka. She's a survivor of the atomic bomb attack of Hiroshima in 1945. Sadai was 12 years old then. She was injured by the blast. She was standing about 2 miles away from the hypocenter when the bomb went off. Both of her parents were killed.
For decades, Sadai refused to talk about the bombing of Hiroshima. But now, in her late 80s, she travels the world to talk about the dangers of nuclear weapons and the reality of war. Here she is, speaking to us through interpreter Tsubasa Kawamoto.
So I was in my first year of intermediate school, so I was 12 at that time. And some part I remember vividly, very vividly. So that's what I talk about in my testimony. But probably I do have parts that I close myself, so I don't remember exactly what happened.
To the extent that you're willing to share, tell us about what you remember from the moment of the blast and from the aftermath.
So at the moment of the explosion, I saw a very bright flash, like a sun right in front of me, and I lost consciousness. Then I thought, when I got conscious, I thought something really bad is going to happen again. Then I escaped. I evacuated to the air raid shelter. And I came out of the shelter, but I still had no idea what was going on and what happened. Where I was at that time, people escaped from the city center, and seeing those people who are so badly burned, I suddenly got to worry about my parents who were working on building demolition in the city center. And in the evening, my parents are still not home. And I got to hear that my father is in the city center. So I got my brother to take my father back from the city center. But he was almost dead at that time. And we had no idea about my mother. And after a few days, I got to know that she was in the relief station in the island called Ninoshima, where we saw her name in the registration book. And we got to know that she passed away there. And what what we were given in the island was a small bag of some hair, which could be anyone's, and some bone, which could be anyone's. And so that's how I got to know that both of my parents passed away. And after I lost my parents, our life got tough. We had very tough life after losing our parents. And my brother gave up on studying, and he got a job. So we had very small income. And my sisters, older sisters, who were married into different families, came back to our house, and they contributed to the housework. So that's how I got to survive, and I am very thankful to my brothers and sisters.
頭の傷は、ガラスの傷は…
My head was injured by the glasses piercing into my head because of the blast. It got taken out after some days, but I had some skin eruptions all over my body. And because we had no medication, because we had no medicines around that time, it took more than half a year for them to be cured. And when it got cured, pus oozed out of the eruption. And when people saw that, people said, oh, the poison gas came out of her body. We believed that the atomic bombing is actually poison gas bomb. That's what we believed at that time, because no one knew about the atomic bomb, nuclear weapons, or the effect of radiation around that time.
Next, we sat down with a panel of high school students who recently traveled to New York City. They participated in the worldwide climate strikes and Day of Action.
The students agree that our society will have to make changes, big changes, starting with our own consumption habits. That could mean smaller houses, different ways to get around, fewer material possessions. And we wondered, are there fellow students on board with that kind of mindset? You'll hear Liam Smith and Radesh Singh from Brighton High School, but first, here's Lindsay Cody of Honey I Falls, Lima.
I mean, realistically, looking forward, we are going to have to drastically minimize our consumption as a society. We are a consumer culture, and that's just going to have to be one of the things that changes if we want to have a livable future. We have an incredible opportunity right now to completely rework our society. You know, there are a lot of things wrong with it, but if we want to adequately combat climate change, a lot of things are going to have to change, and we need to start viewing that as more of an opportunity and not a burden that we have.
But there are decades of work in our society to teach kids to work hard, become adults, be contributing society members, and they can have whatever they want in life. They can have a massive house. They can have several cars in the garage. You okay with giving up a dream for those kinds of things?
I am completely okay with that.
Maybe you never had that dream.
Yeah, I may be the minority on that, but yeah, it's going to have to be a big culture shift to start expecting different things of your future and not be working towards the, you know, three-car lifestyle, because that's destructive.
And before I turn to your colleagues here, for a moment, forget people like Radesh and Liam and think about everyone you go to school with. Do you think the general population of students you go to school with is okay with that kind of a change?
Honestly, I don't, but they're going to have to be, because they have to start viewing this as an issue that threatens their existence.
I appreciate the honesty. So what's it going to take to get more of your fellow students to that acceptance?
I think right now people are seeing it as, you know, youth climate activists, we're just people who really like the earth, and they're not connecting it back to the fact that this is going to affect every aspect of life. And I think once people start seeing that this plays into the economy and this plays into more than just, you know, trees outside, then they'll start caring and, you know, start wanting to act more.
Okay. Radesh.
Yeah, just wanted to echo that. Like, sometimes you might label climate activists or especially youth climate activists as just tree huggers that just like to frolic around the prairies trying to catch butterflies.
I never used the word frolic, but
but in reality, climate change is fundamentally, it has an economic component. It has a social component. It has a cultural component. It has a national security component. It has a refugee component. Because climate change is such an intersectional issue, and it affects all issues that our worlds face, that to not be a climate activist is to basically be sticking your head in the ground and just basically muting the entire world out. Because if we don't deal with this crisis, all the other issues that we see, whether that be violence, famine, hunger, world peace, they're going to just get exponentially worse. So addressing this is so pivotal and so fundamental for society to move forward if we want to actually have a future. It kind of boggles my mind when people say, oh, this is not a real big issue. This is just some bunch of tree huggers that want to go catch some butterflies.
Liam, you were direct earlier this hour about your combination of optimism and pessimism. Mm-hmm. Gene is talking about creating a world in which culturally, or who knows, through other means, but we have an acceptance that abundance means something different than maybe we've been taught to think in the last 50 years. Do you think your fellow students, and again, I'm not talking about just the ones in this room, believe that and accept that?
I think some of them do. I also think it's a very complicated issue when you talk about changing material wealth or material expectations. I think it's a tough line to draw between, you know, restricting freedom of choice and protecting the environment, or it can be sometimes. So for instance, eating meat, especially beef, is very bad for the environment because cows and other animals release methane into the atmosphere, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. And so when we're factory farming these animals, we just multiply the effect of that global warming. And so that's one example where it's tricky because it's, you can't just tell everyone you can't eat meat. But at the same time, we need like a cultural shift away from eating meat at every meal and eating a lot of meat at every meal. So I think you need to strike a balance here between, you know, government regulation and consumer choice. And I think that can be done through carefully choosing what are you subsidizing and what are you not subsidizing. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I think our political leaders need to think very carefully about is how do we encourage sustainable growth without restricting freedom of choice.
Finally, if everything feels polarized these days, well, social media is probably partially to blame. New research finds that using social media increases stress, anxiety, and depression. We talked about ways to stay engaged without losing our minds.
Norma Holland was a longtime news anchor for Channel 13 in Rochester, and now she works for the Digital Hive. She talked about the perils of social media, especially when the trolls try to get you down.
I mean, it can get in your pores and can become part of the... We all have a narrative, right? Every day we get up and we talk to ourselves. And if you say you don't, you're lying. Every day you get up and you say, all right, self, today I'm going to get up. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to take care of my kids. I'm going to do the best I can. But when you absorb so much of that negativity on social media, it can become part of your own narrative. And if you believe what people say about you, that is also extremely damaging. Any message you hear over and over and over is going to become imprinted on your DNA if you don't do what you can to mitigate the damage. It's just like verbal abuse as a kid, you know, someone, the taunts, or from an abusive parent, you know, it can become part of that merry-go-round in your head. So yeah, absolutely. You must pick and choose on a day-to-day basis what you will absorb and what you will deflect.
And what about the idea of sort of cracking back or deciding to walk away or to block or to mute?
I mean,
sometimes the temptation is to crack back.
Yeah, no. I have.
You almost never feel better when you do
that.
You don't.
But I will give you one example of when you clap back, how actually you might change a person's mind. Mm-hmm. So you may recall a couple of years ago, I became embroiled in something. A bit of a scandal, and I'm not going to talk about it openly.
I don't want people overly speculating. It's in regards to the news, and it wasn't any of Norma's direct reporting.
No.
It was more about parental corporate heads, etc. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
So long story short, a man actually wrote to me the most vile, awful message. And I had been deciding for days whether or not to write back to the thousands of people who were writing to me. And in many cases, I did. And my sister was like, you're a juggernaut. You just, you know, take a hit and you keep coming back and you writing all these people. And I'm on, you know, the GIF or GIF of Kermit. And he's, you know, on the computer and he's typing real fast. That was me. That was me.
That GIF is you?
That was me for days. I was wearing a green suit. You didn't know. And I wrote back to this guy and I said, listen, who was so mean to you as a child that you feel it is okay to talk to another human being this way? Shame on you. And I knew this guy. He was from the same town I live in. I go, dude, I probably run across you in Wegmans. And you're going to talk to me? You don't even know me. Well, I let him have it. I didn't care. I was like, filter or no filter, I'm letting this dude, I'm putting him right in his place. And after I did it, I felt so vindicated. And I was like, there. And I walked away. And then I felt rotten. I said, oh, why did I do that? You know, when you start getting in the muck with someone, it feels awful. Sure. Long story short, he wrote me back with this apology. You're right. I'm so sorry. Can you please forgive me? I should have never reached out to you with such vitriol. I don't even know you. I said, well, okay, you know, we can talk. And we did. And we had a conversation. Long story short, he didn't agree with me. He didn't agree with anything I was, like, in terms of whether or not I should have done, blah, 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 whatever. But he apologized. So sometimes even the trolls have a heart. You just got to really dig deep. But what did I expend to get to that point? And was it worth it?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, the return on investment with that's probably pretty low. But at the same time, you and I have talked for years about how it used to be before social media, phone calls and emails, and people never think that you're going to get back to them. They'll send you the nastiest thing, and they just don't expect a reply. So oftentimes I'll reply and I'll say, boy, I'm really sorry I've disappointed you so much and that you know so much about me, considering we've never met.
Yeah. Well, sometimes that disarms people.
It does, because they don't expect to get it. They think they're just blasting out into the void.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I think social has made that more immediate and more constant. And then the question becomes, how often do you want to invest the energy to do that? You got a return on that one case, and that probably mattered. It mattered to him.
Well, I guess it did, because I remember it, and it stuck with me as an example.
But you probably responded
humanity.
To a lot that got no response or just more trolling. And then you're like, well, am I just feeding the fire here? So,
yeah, I remember I let go with this one lady. She said something like, you watch yourself, girly, or whatever, or girl. And I said, no, you watch yourself, Pam. Her name was Pam.
Pam.
Letta, it's like, you watch yourself, Pam. You think you are. Call me girl.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.